Well, good morning, everyone. My name's Will. I think I know most of you, and if not, I'm Will. The passage we're about to look at has got a lot in it, like a huge passage. So we're going to try and get a major theme running through it that will hopefully be helpful to us. And there's lots of themes that are going to be left behind. That's the reality of this. It's way too big a passage to get into, to get all of it out. In Gethsemane, this is Gethsemane, is the place where Jesus is here. Gethsemane, the word actually means oil press. So it's like a place of pressure, a place where things are pressed to make into something different. And that's the place that we start in. I think there are a riot of different threads going on, but I think throughout there's going to be one single golden thread that we're going to try and hang on to as we look at this. And the golden thread actually comes, and it's called, the golden thread is His love endures forever, which we read at the beginning of the service. This has been one of my more interesting journeys in my Christian life, has been preparing for this sermon, where I thought Gethsemane was just this kind of rubbish passage in the Bible that I never quite understood and just frustrated me, to one that I can start to see that there's something revealing of God's deep heart for a broken world in a way that I could never see it before. And I hope that you can come on that journey with me today. We're going to look at four key areas as we look at this: God's heart and His character, God's wrath, God's cup of wrath, God's cup of salvation, and finally, our cup of suffering in a broken world. Just before we get into Matthew 26, I want to read one final verse to you. This was a verse that unlocked it all for me, and I found really helpful. Here it is. Where is it? I've lost it. Verse 30. When they had sung a hymn, they went to the Mount of Olives. That verse is very profound, although it's very missed. When they had sung a hymn, they went to the Mount of Olives. So what's the question that follows that? What hymn? What hymn? What hymn did they sing? That's what my little mind went, what hymn did they sing? It wasn't Graham Kedrick. That was written in 1983. What they sang, actually, is something called a Hallel, which is a group of Psalms, 113 to 118. They sang half of them before the Passover and half of them after the Passover. I didn't know this. I just learnt this. Psalms, when you come away from today, my recommendation is you read those Psalms, particularly thinking about Gethsemane and what God is doing. But let me just read out some of the themes of the things that Jesus was singing just before he went to Gethsemane. This is the hymn that Jesus sang. I'm just going to read some bits out. Not to us, our Lord, not to us, but your name be the glory because of your love and faithfulness. The Lord is gracious and righteous. Our God is full of compassion. For the Lord has delivered my soul from death. My eyes and tears, my feet from stumbling. His love endures forever. His love endures forever. His love endures forever. His love endures forever. That goes over and over and over again through the hymn. His love endures forever, forever. The Lord is my strength, my song. He has become my salvation. And the very last words he sings are, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. The final words of the song he sings before he goes to Gethsemane. So what's ringing in Jesus' ears? His end for? For how long? For how long? Wow. So he's going to be humming in the Garden of Gethsemane. What's he humming? And how long is that? Forever. So if you want to leave now, you've got the gist of it, okay? His love endures forever. And it's all hidden in one little tiny verse, and they sang a hymn. This is the engine room of what's going on here. Right in the heart of it, the engine room is here. And we get to know it. The engine room in Gethsemane, the golden thread is that God's love, his love, endures forever. And the word love is a Hebrew word, which some of you have heard me talk about in our prayer meeting, but the word is hesed. It begins with kind of a funny C at the beginning, hesed, which is a Hebrew word. And this love means his covenantal love, his faithfully committed love, his relational love. It's one of the most profound words in the Old Testament when it's describing God's love for his world. It's like a linked to love, a one that doesn't let go kind of love. So as the engine room is his hesed love endures forever. I think English is terrible here, where love conjures up a couple of like just kind of squeaky hearts and Cupid's firing arrows. But this is a really deep, grounded, profound love that is rooting God into this story. And Jesus has just finished with the words, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures for forever." Thank you. And then he goes into this place called the oil press, the Gethsemane Garden. What a contrast. He's just been singing this truth of this deep, amazing truths of God's love. And then he's suddenly in this place. And I was telling you to look out for the pattern of three. Did anybody spot any threes that we learned about? Anybody spot any threes? Prayer. Yes. Three times, isn't he? Three times, he says, "Lord, take this cup, Lord." And three times he says to his disciples, "Stay awake, pray with me. Stay awake, pray with me. Stay awake, pray with me." The three represents total, complete. It's not like a little bit, it's complete. It's like three times that pattern in the Old Testament and the New Testament was like something is absolutely, absolutely, absolutely something. So in this case, it's representing absolute human failure, unfortunately. It's three times he says, "Stay awake," and they fall asleep. "Stay awake," and they fall asleep. "Stay awake," and they fall asleep. So Jesus in Gethsemane is in this place of absolute abandonment from his human friends. And I strongly resonate with the disciples. When it comes to falling asleep when you've been asked to stay awake, I am an expert. I have zero staying power. At the minute, I can't even get through an episode of Death in Paradise without falling asleep. Isn't that right, Roddy? I would have no chance in this garden, but I would want to, but I'd have no chance. But that's all of us, isn't it? We're all a bit like that. There's a bit of this staying power that we're all a bit broken. We're not the ones that Jesus can ultimately rely on to go with him. This is a journey that he has to make on his own. And that's the point that it's making here. He has to do this walk on his own. He's not going to be dependent on other humans to enable him to do this walk. But it's on his own. And Peter, the rock. Is Peter the rock here? Three times? I don't know this man. What are you talking about? Never seen him before. You've got a very similar accent to him. No idea who he is. To little girls asking him. No idea. Don't know him. Don't know him. Don't know him. Three denials. And then the rooster crows. So these symbols of three continue to represent this absolute abandonment, absolute human failure from his closest disciples. The rock Peter abandons him. So Jesus is in this place of total rejection, denial, and he's on his own. To me, this is such a strong contrast. We've just read the character of God, his love endures forever, and then the human character of people where they just don't endure forever. They can't endure forever. And I think that's the same for our lives. There is no human in your lives who will be able to endure forever for you. If you're thinking, if I can just get the right partner, my life, I'll be fine, it'll endure forever. It won't. It's not like that. If you can say, I just get the right job or the right pay packet, I'll be fine. It won't. It's not strong enough. If you can say, we just get the right political party into power, it'll be fine. It's not going to be fine. But our hope is in God. It's such a strong contrast. It goes back to the Psalm 118. His love endures forever. The other, we keep moving through the passage, I'm just summarising it quickly, but we get to the chief priest, and he was meant to be the cornerstone. It kind of, you can lose it quite quickly, but the whole point of the chief priest is they're the cornerstone between God and people. And yet this chief priest isn't like that at all. He's not a spiritual leader. He ends up ultimately rejecting and condemning Jesus, who is the real cornerstone, the one that's rejected, the rejected cornerstone. So you have the one who's meant to be the cornerstone, the chief priest, rejecting Jesus and saying, you can't be God. The priest goes on and tears his cloak in anger. That would be make you unclean. It was just something that priest wasn't allowed to do. That cloak was special. So he had made himself unclean, and it was almost an act of vandalism towards God in his anger. So you get this real contrast again between the spiritual leaders of the time and Jesus. The spiritual leaders, even they are rejecting Jesus and doing unclean things while they're rejecting him. It's easy to miss, but the whole point is that chief priest is meant to be the cornerstone. He makes himself unclean and he rejects Jesus for blasphemy. And yet Jesus has to take it all. So Jesus is in this place of total rejection. Rejection from his disciples, they're asleep. Rejection from Peter, he's there verbally rejecting him, calling down curses on himself. And rejection from the Jewish leaders who accuse him of blasphemy and make themselves unclean in the act of doing it. Yet, we've got a golden thread still, and we have to hang on to this. God's character is still at work. His love endures forever. And we get into Gethsemane and we have this confusing thing where Jesus is saying, take this cup from me, but not my will, but your will, God. Take this cup from me, but not your will. Not my will, but your will, God. Take this cup from me, God, but not my will, but be your will, your will. So what is this cup? Well, we get it in Psalm 75. It is God who judges. He brings one down, he exalts another. In the hand of the Lord is a cup. In the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He pours it out all the wicked of the earth, and he drinks it down to its very dregs. So what's the cup? The cup is judgment. Isaiah 51. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You who have drained it to its dregs, the goblet that makes people stagger. So it's God's judgment is in the cup. That's what's in the cup. It's the judgment of God. In Romans 3, it helps us unpack it. It says, no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned. All have sinned. And all fall short of the glory of God. So what's the standard that we're trying to get to? The glory of God. And where have we got to? We've all fallen short of that standard. And what does that mean? It means that because we're below the standard, God pours his cup of judgment on the world. That's what the cup is. Our wrongdoings are in this cup. Our failures go into this cup. Our sins are in this cup. Something from every day last week is in this cup. And the big picture of judgment on the earth is the greed of the world is in this cup. The needless wars are in this cup. The human judgments that are wrong are in this cup. Sex trafficking is in this cup. Drug dealing is in this cup. Financial swindlers and skyscrapers are in this cup. Their actions are in this cup. And also you and me, our thoughts are in this cup. Our unjustified thoughts that are wrong are in this cup. Lust, greed, the list goes on and on. All of this is in the cup. It's God's right judgment poured out on a world for its wickedness. The picture is a cup of wrath. The cup that Jesus is wrestling with, the cup Jesus dreads. The cup is a fearful and a dreadful cup. It's full of wrath and hostility. The whole judgment of the world. When Jesus ponders this, he says these words: "My soul is sorrowful to the point of death." May seem weird to you, but our sins put us in direct opposition to God. That's what happens. In conflict with God. God's wrath, his righteousness and fair wrath, they become a blockage. But Jesus has a plan. Jesus' plan is to drink the cup. Jesus has a plan to remove the cup of wrath. And how does he do it? He does it by using his blood. Jesus is planning to take the full wrath of God on himself. Jesus is asking, "But can the cup be removed? But not my will, your will, God." The story actually starts all the way back in the Garden of Eden, where humanity reaches out to consume the forbidden fruit, demonstrating a core rejection of a relationship with God. Instead of living with God day by day, in step with God, it grasps for self and declares it, "Not God, I want to eat of the fruit. Not God's will, but mine," is what is being talked about by Adam in Eden. "Not God's will, but mine," is what Adam is about. And that single act of rebellion starts this whole cascade. It's staggering. Judgment inside this bitter cup comes from that single act of rebellion. That's the root. It's like one giant set of dominoes cascading throughout the world. The first domino falls with Adam, and all the other dominoes of our lives have fallen. Now, in this crushing pressure of Gethsemane, Jesus is there to reverse that curse of the wrath of God poured out on all of the fallen dominoes. So he reaches out, he ponders the wrath, but he perfectly submits to God's will. So it's the opposite of what happens in Gethsemane. Gethsemane, the garden, is the opposite of Eden. In Eden, it's all, Adam, it's about my will. In the Garden of Gethsemane, "Not my will, but your will, God." He's undoing the very thing that happened at the start. Jesus is starting a new beginning here. And his battle cry is, "Not my will, but yours, God. Not my will, but yours." The same cup, the cup of wrath, becomes the cup of salvation. It's the same cup. So in Gethsemane, Jesus repairing the garden. He's repairing creation. He's repairing our lives. And how's he doing it? He's by drinking the cup. He's transforming the cup. In Eden, after there's a broken relationship, what happens? Well, thorns grow up. There are thorns growing up everywhere. And what happens as Jesus deals with this curse? He gets a crown of thorns. It's a visual of the wrath of Eden is being turned into a crown. So now in Jesus, there's a solitary domino standing again, and through his drinking the cup, he's inviting us to be dominoes that can stand with him. So this is the cup, Jesus dying in our place on a cross, a once and for all sacrifice, the spotless, perfect lamb for us, pouring out our blood for us. So the cup of God's wrath is transformed to the cup of God's salvation. It's the same cup. Let's just jump back a little bit. When Jesus was done at the Last Supper, he says to his disciples, "This is my body broken for you. This is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of many." And he's talking about the blood in the cup. And you can recall what he's been singing. His love endures forever. This is the engine room of what Jesus is doing. The engine room is the character of God as he takes on the wrath of the world, the wrath, the righteous wrath of God, and deals with it. He's motivated by love. In Romans it says, "But God demonstrated his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us." A demonstration of his own love for us. Since now we are counted as just, we're no longer counted under the wrath of God, but we're now counted as just by his blood. How much more shall we be saved from God's wrath now? So it's wonderful. What happens with Jesus? He deals with the wrath of God through his blood, and now we are free. The cup has been drained to its very dregs. And in Psalm 116, one of the psalms that they'd been singing in the garden, he says, "I will lift up the cup of salvation," is what he sings. So when Jesus is preparing to go to Gethsemane, he already sings, "I will lift up the cup of salvation and call on the name of the Lord." So the cup of the wrath of God is transformed by Jesus and his sacrifice into the cup of salvation for all. Only God can do that. And the cup of salvation, that if you look at what it actually means in Hebrew, the actual word is Yeshua, and it comes from the same root word Jesus comes from. It's the same word. The cup of salvation is the cup of Jesus. The cup of Jesus. Because Jesus means salvation. It's the same plan.
Hallelujah.
Thank you, Doc. So when Jesus is lifting up the cup, he's offering to fill it with his own identity, his own life, his own total deliverance. So immediately Jesus is singing in 116, in Psalm 116, and then immediately goes to Gethsemane to deal with the cup and transform it from the cup of wrath into a cup of salvation for all. What does that sound like? The act of transforming a cup of wrath into a cup of salvation. What does that sound like? It sounds like his love endures forever. It starts to feel like the embodiment of those words, doesn't it? His love endures forever. Embodied in a person, Jesus. So what does it mean for us? Well, it means now we stand with 0, 0, 0 condemnation from God. There is none. The full wrath of God is dealt with in Jesus. The full wrath of God is dealt with in Jesus. And now all that flows from Jesus to us is salvation. So when bad things happen to us, is it God's judgment on us? It's not. It's now never God's judgment on us. There is no judgment, none, from God on us now because of Jesus. Just one cup, the cup of salvation, transformed into that by Jesus' blood. So to summarize, one cup, it's the wrath of God for the sins of the world. But it's dealt with by Jesus on a cross, where it becomes the salvation for everyone. And the engine room for all of this is the refrain, his love endures forever. But we can also feel that the world isn't just a place that feels like his love endures forever every day of our lives. We also want to think about our cup of suffering as well. I don't know about you, but in our current reality, we all have personal cups of struggle and pain. You might be holding a really bitter cup right now. I don't know. You might have grief, illness, betrayal, or isolation in your life right now. In the last week, I have been so aware of a cup of suffering in this world. I have known conversations dealing with devastating terminal illness, advanced cancer, of death. I've been struck by the pain and weight of suffering all around us. In the present time, we're in a world with real and heartbreaking suffering happening. You too will have your own story of this. You too will be able to speak of how sad and painful that cup is. I'm going to invite a friend, Isilda, to come and share a little bit of her own story of her cup, because I think it helps us as we reflect too. Thanks, Isilda. Cup.
Can you take the mic off?
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Got some advanced thinkers in the group, which is really good.
Thank you for that.
Isilda and I were chatting after she'd been to our house, and I was thinking about this passage, and I asked her a little bit, and she told me a little bit of her own personal story of her cup. So what did it feel like to have a cup of suffering?
Well, when you come to a place where you're going to pray that take this cup away from me, you're pretty much on your knees. That's a prayer that you very much do on your knees. And for me, it came when I made a bad choice. I had a marriage that's very difficult, and my husband had a drink addiction, which we fought for about 20 years, but unfortunately we weren't able to overcome this. So, but I suffered physically and emotionally from it, and was a very difficult thing. But I was brought up in a family that is no divorce and you don't give up on your husband. So I fought really hard for it. I wish I had read that passage in the Bible that says, do not be unevenly yoked. So, but unfortunately I was young, and but I took the commitment of a marriage very seriously. And it came to a point that after 20 years, when he was arrested and I was injured, and And I thought it was better for him not to come back after. We did fight for many years, but it was better for me and the children if he did not come back. So, it was a difficult time because he went through a lot. He was a violent man also, especially when he drank. He had good bits. I married him because he had a kind heart, and I saw the nicest thing in him. But with the time, that seemed to disappear. And so did my identity, because I was living just to help him and the children, and I didn't know who I was anymore. So, yeah, it was difficult. So when he was arrested, and he daily rang me, threatened to kill me or, you know, to injure me. And so I never knew when he was going to knock on the door, walk in Inverness, if it was the back, you know. It was very, very difficult. And so I prayed, God, can you do something with him, please? You know, just make him disappear or something. And God was just not answering my prayers. And I said, I was praying the wrong prayer. So I decided to pray that God help him. God bless him. Bless him with a job, with a home, friends, health, all good things. And you know what? God did. God blessed him and changed me. And when he blessed him, he stopped bugging me because he had all the good things. So that was wonderful, but I was still afraid. So I went to a ladies' convention once, I think it was with this church actually, many years ago, where the ladies prayed and they said, if you have a burden, put it at the foot of the cross. We had a cross and they were giving a little stone to put at the foot of the cross. With Tai Chi, then I said, God, please take this burden from me. And by the time I put the stone at the foot of the cross, even before I went to my seat, it just lifted up. It just lifted up. It was amazing how God works in amazing ways. So after a few years he got a sheltered home, he got a medical care, he got a cleaner, he got people to do shopping for him. And I knew he was ill. I think my children still had contact with him. He fell ill. And I prayed, oh God, please don't ask me to look after him. Please don't ask me to look after him. Because I knew if he had asked, and if God said, go look after him, I would have gone. I would have given the life that I've made for me and my children, a new beginning for me. And I said, I'll have to give up and go and look after him. So that was my knee's prayer. Please take this cup away from me. I really don't want to do that, but if you ask, I will go. But God is amazing. Our God is, his love endures forever. And I felt a veil of love around me, and nothing that happened around me seemed to affect anymore. I was just covered by his love. And my husband got the help he needed, but he was a proud man. He would not have a cleaner in his flat. He would not have the help he was offered. He would not have the ambulance he offered. So the weirdest thing happened. The care home where he was, the sheltered home, rang me one night and said, your husband needs to go to the hospital. We need to get a bed for him. He'll be cared for, but he doesn't want to go. So I said, well, pass the phone to him. So I said to him, look, you've been offered help. Take this help. We'll go and visit you. We'll go and see you. You know, make sure you get the care. And my words were the last words he heard in the morning when they came for me. I had passed away. And so after that, I was blessed, you know, with my prayers for help. And I said, how am I going to feel now? He died. Was I good enough? Could I have done more? You know, but I was blessed with friends, angels, that's sitting in this very church. Mary McChain there, hiding her wings. Yes, Marion and Ken, and then after that, you know, up to this day, I have words of encouragement and love. Dot there, you know, hi Dot, always encouraging Louise and so many others, you know, thank you so much. But the way God protected me was amazing. So the day we scatter his ashes, my children gathered together and they were talking and cuddling each other. And I felt, for the first time, I felt alone and I felt left out. And I come from a culture we hug. And I just need a hug, but they were doing the wrong thing. And on the way home, I prayed, Lord, please, please, I need, I don't know why I'm feeling like that. You sheltered me so far. We stopped at Tesco, and as around the vegetable aisle, here comes a friend who gave me a hug. Mm-hmm. And before I left the Tesco, she gave me a bunch of flowers. Mm-hmm. And I went for a walk in the Dorswood where I usually pray. And I said, oh God, you're good to me, but you know, it's still not there yet. Around the corner comes a friend who preached at the Hilton Church. He ministered to me and gave me a big hug. So I said, well, thank you. And all those years, his love endures forever. And he gives this love to us to give to others, and I receive it. And I don't think I shared to you that a couple of years later, one just before Christmas, I used to love to dance. I was a ballerina once, and I lost the joy to dance because of my husband drinking. So I was watching this couple dancing on TV, and I said, oh, Lord, I felt so much pain. And I said, Lord, I wish I could dance again. One last dance, Father. Could I have one last dance? Well, my daughter had rung and said, Mom, remember we're going to the cathedral. This person singing like Michael Bublé. I said, oh, well, that'd be nice. I'll go for the Bublé. So we sat at the very front of the church, at the cathedral, the candlelight. He's singing beautifully. And this man, out of nowhere, took me for a dance right in the middle of the cathedral. And that wasn't the only miracle. My daughter was filming it, laughing her head off. And when I listened to her video, I still have the video, he was singing, Darling, save your last dance for me. Mm. So thank you, God, for his good indeed.
Can I ask you, Isilda, one last question? Isilda, come back. I think your final question was in one or two lines. What would you say to others who are suffering, just in one or two lines?
Well, ask a Brazilian person to say something, one or two lines.
You can have five.
Yes, I say, don't give up. If God doesn't answer a prayer, he has a good reason, because the ones he did answer me, I learned from that. So keep faith, keep praying, and be the hand of God in so many other people's lives as well, as you were in mine. So remember that cup that we all said is also a cup of joy that he will give you at the right time. So bless you.
Thanks, Isilda. We're nearly at the end, and I hadn't realised I should have invited Isilda to preach instead of me, so sorry about that, everyone. Thank you, Isilda. Yeah, those are very powerful words, and it's a very powerful story that through the hard times, his love endures forever. Just coming to a close here, so there's more to it. There's threads running all over the place, but the golden thread of our God is his love endures forever. And we've got credible people in our congregation talking about their suffering and God's thread of his love endures forever. In Revelation 7, one of the young people shared this verse with us at a prayer meeting. I'm just going to read out a little bit of it, but I think it's important. This is just after this is a vision of heaven, and this is like a big picture. This is some of this cracked open, looking at the bigger picture. It says in verse 13, "Then one of the elders asked me, 'These in white robes, who are they? And where do they come from?' I answered, 'Sir, you know.' And he said, 'These are they who have come out of great tribulation, great difficulties. They have washed their robe and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence.'" So the golden thread his love endures forever is to flow into us and now through us, through the blood of the Lamb. And where does it leave us? Well, it leaves us with a God who says he will shelter us with his presence. That's what it leads us into. So what is our great hope? That the blood of Jesus poured out into us will give us direct access to God. And the word shelter here is a bad translation as well. It really means bring us into the Holy of Holies. Bring us into the deep heart of God. So Jesus opens up his throne room of God by his action of taking the wrath of God and drinking it. We get access to God. And we get to understand the full weight of his glory and of his love. So the final bit of all of this is just what Zilda said, that we are to be Jesus' hands and feet to the world. The analogy switches in Revelation and suddenly the lamb becomes the shepherd and we become the sheep. It gets a little bit confusing and I don't have time to unpack it all. But the point is that Jesus becomes the shepherd and he says we are to be the sheep of his. So we become again God's love into the world. So for all of us, we become the love that is to stand in the gap for others as we follow Jesus, declaring and singing, his love endures forever, with acts of love into a world full of pain. We have a hope that one day that pain will cease. That's our ultimate hope as Christians as we get to heaven. But right now, we live with this thread that goes all the way into heaven, but isn't yet there, so we continue to declare his love endures forever. So sometimes I think in this world, our role is to sing his love endures forever, and we've done that beautifully today. I think some scenarios, all we can do is whisper it. And I think that people can't hear the full voice of it being sung. I think in some scenarios we have to enact it. I think we can't even say it. And I think in some scenarios we have to wipe away the tears and be the practical love in a broken world. But the root of all of this is God's character. His love endures forever. That's the thread that runs through all of this. So the engine room of God's activity in Gethsemane is his hesed love endures forever. The golden thread is his love endures forever.